Thanks for listening to Chicago's Morning Answer podcast, sponsored by Signature Bank. Signature Bank takes pride in helping customers grow their business and provide unmatched banking expertise, custom financial solutions, and the industry's best technology. So whether you're a business looking for a deposit relationship or needs a ready source of financing, Signature Bank is the right bank for you. Call today at 773-467-5600 to hear how Signature Bank can help your business grow and thrive. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.
This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. So Caterpillar executives announced yesterday they will not be the last ones to turn out the lights in Illinois. How about you? 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line, 646-36DA, turnkey.pro text line, another Fortune 500, Fortune 100 company, at least with respect to their corporate headquarters, moving to Texas, where they've been investing for some time, divesting from Illinois. Now, I know what people are going to say,
what?
The defenders in office, right? The there's nothing to see here crowd. 230 corporate executives.
Mm-hmm.
That's it. It's 230 corporate executives. We still have the greatest global concentration of CAD employees in Illinois. And so, you know, some executives choose to relocate. You know, there's companies moving here all the time. They never really provide much in terms of the details
That,
but that's what they say. Companies moving in all the time, corporate executives, corporate offices move all the time. It's not a big deal.
Oh, yeah. Pritzker's reaction, Governor Pritzker, wannabe President Pritzker, said that the state is still seeing, quote, increased job growth thanks to his administration's policies. Oh, really? Did anybody press him on that? What kind of job growth are we seeing? Because Caterpillar moved from Peoria to Deerfield and now Deerfield to Fort Worth, Dallas. Where, by the way, Texas is home to 54 Fortune 500 corporations.
Yeah, it was
because
just
why?
Last,
it's a friendly place to do business.
It was just last month, I know, that the governor, doing a purposeful misreading of a census audit. The latest numbers show Illinois is now a state on the rise, growing population. House Speaker and girlfriend beater Chris Welch echoed the same sentiment last month that, hey, it's what Democrats have been saying all along, folks. Illinois is growing. Illinois is thriving. Illinois has so much to offer. It does have so much to offer, which is why it's so curious that it's really not growing. It's really not thriving. What it's seeing is the greatest exodus since the Israelites fled Egypt. And that's what's actually happening. So, you know, the thing about 230 executives or the Boeing executives, it's sort of what their reaction to, you know, 105,000 people with a annual gross income, combined annual gross income of $10 billion walking out the door last calendar year alone. It's a big deal.
The CEO of Caterpillar, his comment, we believe it's the best strategic interest of the company to make this move, which supports Caterpillar's strategy for profitable growth as we help our customers build a better world.
You know, when you have, see, the thing about corporate offices like that,
yes,
it's driven by, well, you know, the executives in those corporate offices. And what it tells you, sort of a leading indicator of a certain perspective among a certain strata, which is to say, you know, we don't want to be in Deerfield. We don't want to be in Illinois. And it's not just, you know, a handful of CAT executives or a handful of Boeing executives saying that. That's indicative of a larger attitude in the population among successful people who don't see Illinois in their future. You know, when I ran for governor back in 2010 and 2009, we were talking about this because we were noticing, some of us, not all of us, but some of us, few conservatives were noticing, you know, Caterpillar, and by the way, the local populations noticed because of how important Cat is to Peoria, how important John Deere is to the Quad Cities, how important ADM was to Decatur.
Maytag to
Galesburg. That's a long time ago.
I know,
right,
but still.
But right, but you look at Galesburg, or you look at machine shops leaving Rockford and the devastation, and you say, "Well, whoa!" Those communities that where those big companies are muy importante, yeah, they notice what's going on. They pay attention, and so as I was saying, more than a decade ago, you're looking at the CapEx investments that ADM, John Deere, Caterpillar are making, and you're noticing that their global headquarters are here and their investments are in places like Nebraska and Oklahoma and Texas and Iowa and elsewhere. And so sort of, warning that the bridge is rickety back 15 years ago, saying, you know, when you see a company making investments, particularly in states that are similarly situated, like, you know, you're an agribusiness and you're investing in Iowa rather than Illinois. You know, agribusiness is the number one sector, the biggest sector in Illinois, and you're not investing here and you're a big player in agribusiness. That says something. It says that these companies don't move quickly, but they telegraph what their attitude is and where they may be moving in the not so distant future. First, you start divesting, and then you move all together. And that's what's been happening over the better part of a decade and a half. It's just that few people noticed it. Politicians didn't want to pay attention to it. And, of course, nobody wanted to change the way that Illinois works in this state, at least nobody who got elected. 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line. 64636-DA, turnkey.pro text line. Mark in Rochelle.
Yeah, just to go along with what you're talking about, I just relearned last night that the fourth family of lifelong teachers that are retiring are leaving the state, and they're taking their pension. They're going to build a home in Tennessee. So, yeah, it's like it's a double-edged, double jeopardy, I guess I would call it, is not only are we paying a pension out of the Illinois budget, but it's leaving the state and not getting spent here.
Sure, take your booty and go. Absolutely. Yep. Yeah. Thanks for the call, Mark.
Should they be forced to live here if they collect a pension?
Well, you can't force people to live here, but otherwise they would, because that's about the only way you're going to keep people here. I remember when the bridges were up during COVID, and I thought they were executing the East German strategy of building a wall to keep people in, not keep people out. At some point, too, to Mark's point, and of course, there's nobody who doesn't have stories like what Mark just shared. So the thing is, you know, at some point, if you don't want to be left without a chair when the music stops here, you know, I mean, it's never going to, I'm not suggesting the population is going to go to zero. This is metaphoric. But in terms of a quality place to live, then at some point, we need to stop talking about all the people who are gone, and we need to start talking about the people that are here and what they're going to do about it. And, you know, it's interesting to talk about the four families that Mark was saying, four families have left. What about the families that are here? What's that conversation? Is it, do you see it penetrating a larger swath of your circles of influence than maybe 5 years ago or certainly 15 years ago? I don't know. I don't know. Is it? Do you see people in your, so forget the people that have left. We understand why they did that. The people that are here, do you see any attitudinal shift within your, circles of influence that where they say, I wish I would have done things
differently
a decade or decade and a half ago. I didn't understand what was happening. Now I do.
I think people are waking up with the CPS, CTU, I mean, most importantly, and that they could do things differently. They would have moved to a different school district or put their kids in private school.
And so what are they going to do about it now that that's, you know, they don't have a time machine?
Well, these are conversations I hear at graduation parties where they're celebrating. We're done with the CTU. We never have to deal with them ever again. I'm like, well, you were part of the problem because you supported them, which they did. And now, you know, they're just happy to be done with them, and they're all moving.
Okay, so they're the people that are leaving again. So the people that are staying, do you know anybody who's staying who says, you know, not even mea culpa, but like we need to do some things dramatically different. We need a paradigm shift in the state. I didn't recognize it a decade ago, two decades ago. I recognize it now. Now I'm on board for system change. Did you hear that in your social circles? Anybody?
312-642-5600, turnkey.proanswerline. You could also text us at 64636, type in DA, then a quick comment.
Mary Kay in Western Springs.
Hi, good morning, you two. I was thinking, how many people have to move out of Illinois for us to lose electoral votes?
We just lost one, yeah, in the 2020 census, and we probably should have lost two.
So not again until 2030 census,
right.
So that's too long, because I was thinking if we lost more electoral votes, you know, I knew that and forgot it, but if we lost more electoral votes, that'd be a good thing. Loss would go to whoever, what Democrat runs for president.
Well, what have we lost? I mean, we've lost, I think, five electoral votes over the last 40 years.
Yeah. Well, how many do we have right now? It used to be 24.
Isn't it 18?
We're down to 18, I believe.
Yeah. Oh, good. Let's get it down
six,
to like 10.
Five, six, yeah.
If I have to stick around.
Well, okay, so that's one approach to say let's encourage more people to get out so we shrink the state. Let's get it down to Delaware size in terms of population.
Right. Then you and I, like all of us will be left, all of us people, we can hang out, have a good time, maybe try to fix up the aesthetics of this place and, you know, whatever. Maybe we overpower the government that's still here and take it over. I think that would be, you know, if I'm here, if I have to get stuck here till I'm 70 or 80, God help me if I do, you know, maybe we'll just have a party at the end there, Dan. You know, I don't know. Is it a bad idea?
Thanks for the call, Mary Kay. But it's not a great one.
We got a text message. I'm only staying here until my parents die. My kids have all plans to finish college and leave the state.
No, I got that. Yeah. We get that. We know that story. That story is everywhere. The story that I don't hear, and I'm wondering if it's anywhere.
Okay.
I'm here. I'm lashed to the mast, and I didn't get it before, but I get it now, and I'm on board for system change. Like, let's take on and take out at the ballot box the political ruling class in this state. I'm done with establishment Republicans. I'm done with the combine. I'm done with the Republican side of it. I'm done with the Democrat side of it. I get it. I'm on the reform team now. Durkin, Madigan, Harmon, Welch, we need to get rid of them all. We need to start over. We can't start over, but we need to institute fresh reform leadership. Does anybody hear that conversation? Does anybody hear people saying that? That's what I'm asking. I get the leaving. I get the exasperation. I get the secede from Chicago. I got the let's shrink the state to, you know, Delaware size and, you know, I don't go out in a blaze of glory. What about the we can still do this if enough scales fall from enough eyes? Anybody say that? Joe in Chesterton, Indiana.
How you doing? First of all, I really, really like your show. Keep doing what you're doing.
Thanks.
And I had a story about leaving, but you're past that. My answer to your most recent question, unfortunately, is no. I think, or the people I know that the problems are so deep that it's so hard to change. The family is broken down, family structure is down, schools are terrible, no association to organize religion, and get bumbled. I know where do we start? How do we tackle the deep cultural issues?
Well, thanks for the call, Joe. I mean, I think you start at the ballot box, and as long as you have people that agree with you, agree with your diagnosis, Joe, holding themselves out for offices, then, you know, you have a puncher's chance. I agree, it's a slog. There's no question it's going to be a slog. There is no light switch to be flipped where things are going to magically turn around. That's the bill of goods that the Democrat socialists are selling you. Well, they're selling you even a worse and a more ridiculous bill of goods. They're selling you things aren't bad.
Right.
Don't believe your lying
eyes.
That's
what you said. That's what Pritzker said yesterday. You know, despite this, we have a, you know, job growth in Illinois.
Oh, okay. But as long as there are people willing to fight, then you have an opportunity. The question becomes, what are you willing to do?
The stories you need to know to start your day.
Hey, business owners, is your business and money in good hands? Does your bank invest in your success? Hi, Mike Gallagher here, letting you know that when you need a relationship bank, Signature Bank makes commercial banking personal. I love these guys. Not only do they have expansive industry experience, a strong financial track record, but they're also highly capitalized for strategic growth. That's so important. That's why Signature Bank is my bank. They know what it means to grow a business by designing solutions that are right for you and only you. These are real people. They're ready to help. So reach out to my friends at Signature Bank. Make the call today, 773-467-5630. 773-467-5630. Or visit them online at signaturebank.bank. That's signaturebank.bank. Your business could be Signature Bank's next success story. Go online, signaturebank.bank, member FDIC, equal housing lender. Signature Bank.
This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. If you're looking for the latest news, insight into what it means, and the sharpest opinion, there's only one station in Chicago where you can turn, and it's this one. We're AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. More painful, that Kathleen Buell interview on Good Morning America or Amber Heard with Savannah Guthrie?
I'm going with Amber Heard.
Well, yeah, she's definitely dumber, Amber Heard. But let's start with Kathleen Buell, because she was married to Hunter Biden, who is a god to the big guy. We'll get to that. Kathleen Buell, she's out with some memoir about marriage and addiction or some such thing. She's talking, but she doesn't have anything to say. Right. So bizarre. It seems to me she's just another member of this hillbilly family looking to cash in. So I guess that's just part of the culture, even when you're divorced.
But she didn't want to disparage anybody, so she kind of danced around answering the questions, which drives me crazy.
You know, if you're going to write a book and you're going to
own it,
go on Good Morning America, you might have something to say. For example, you know, in the widely circulated pictures and videos we've seen of Hunter Biden, thanks to his carelessness with his laptop, is that the Hunter Biden you were married to? You know, the drug addict, whoremonger, Kathleen.
We've seen images of Hunter, the ones that were on his laptop, looking disheveled. Was that the husband you knew in moments at times?
Not at all. He was struggling under a massive drug addiction, and that's heartbreaking and painful, and that wasn't who I was married to.
She's very understanding, especially given all the prostitutes also not mentioned. She also was queried about her knowledge of Hunter Biden's business dealings, like, you know, did she notice when he was gone for weeks at a time in Ukraine or China?
If you were called to testify, would you have anything to say?
No, I have buried my head in the sand. I really hope that's a lesson that women hear. Understand your finances, take responsibility for them.
Yeah, I hope that's I hope that's a message that Democrat socialists hear, who have their heads deeply buried in the sands. Those ones, the ones that are still clinging, if I could borrow a word, favorite word of theirs, to the Joe Obama administration and to this notion that questions about Hunter Biden or the Biden family are somehow inappropriate, the sort of self-dealing they accused the Trump family of with little evidence. We have a lot of evidence with the Biden family, and, of course, the left is completely uninterested.
I hope her book is more interesting than that interview. The book is If We Break by Kathleen Buell Hunter.
Yeah, I know.
And then did anybody ask her about how she felt when he started dating her sister-in-law?
She sort of sidestepped that, too. You mean when he started dating his brother's widow while he was still married to her?
Yes, that question, Dan.
Yeah. That was uncomfortable. And again, she doesn't want to get into those sorts of details, which is why this was a huge waste of time. And we're sorry we wasted your time now. But you had to hear it. Hunter Biden's ex is going to talk. Is there going to be something interesting?
Nothing.
And the answer is no. Yeah. But now Hunter talking is always interesting because of his complete lack of discipline in all aspects of his life, including running his mouth, again, or looking after his laptop, which is why we know so much about this. So this is something that was recovered, a recording from his laptop. It appears to be Hunter Biden talking to some sort of friend or therapist, but he talks about his involvement in politics and his relationship with his father. And this actually is probative because, of course, of the statements that we know that have become emblematic of the Biden family, save 10% for the big guy, for example. So Hunter Biden's perspective on being involved in politics, because he's, the son of good old Joe.
Right.
You will not get across to everybody, and I have figured out a long time ago, if you're going to be involved in politics the way that I am, which is to choose to engage with my father in that life, because I believe in what he does, if you're going to, then one of your obligations is to use that platform with intent, is to not allow the platform to sit on top of you. I'm allowing the platform to sit on top of me right now.
Yeah, he's talking about the notoriety he's generating. He's not going to be. He was using the platform with intent, the intent to enrich himself and apparently his family, including the old man. That was the intent. And then the notoriety came. And now I guess he's talking about how does he get on top of the platform again rather than the platform sitting on top of him. He explained his relationship with his dad. Basically how his dad is his puppet, who will do anything that he says, and also that he's better than his dad, and he explains how he knows
wow.
that.
Wow.
He's going to talk about drug reform and any other things that I want him to. He'll talk about anything that I want him to, that he believes in. If I say this is important to me, then he will work a way in which to make it a part of his platform. My dad respects me more than he respects anyone in the world, and I know that to be certain. So it is not going to be about whether my dad thinks it's going to affect his politics. No, it won't. It's not going to be whether or not he's going to be embarrassed. I mean, he never will. It's not going to. All of those concerns that you have with all of the people that you know, that are in that are the children of, I have none of them. Not a single one. The only one that I have is the knowledge that it's a different world, not by choice. But I am understanding of that because the person that has lived that life, that has given me this life, is the person I most admire in the world, and I would never change it because it's bigger than me. Everyone else talks about how can you be as good as your dad? I'm better than my dad. You know why I'm better than my dad? Because my dad tells me I'm better than him since I was 2 years old.
I'm a star.
So all of those fears that you think that I have of people not liking me or that I don't love myself, and first I have to go down and you have to really care about yourself and understand and put yourself out there. Baby, have you seen me? Do I not put myself out there?
Yeah.
All of you, you do. He puts himself out there.
That reporter first going,
No, I don't think it's a reporter.
What was that?
No, it's not. It said this is from his laptop. This was not public.
He's talking to
something
somebody.
That was extracted by the Washington Examiner computer geeks. This is
she's somebody, falling all over him.
Talking to a friend or a therapist, which is why you're getting the You know, and how does that make you feel, and so forth. But I mean, just to put a fine point on it,
because the man I most admire in the world, that God to me, thinks I'm a god, and my brother did too.
Wow, one thinks very highly of themselves, huh?
Yeah. God, I would say he's more like Gob, as in Arrested Development, than he is God. But okay. But I thought the interesting part was, you know, the old man, the big guy, will do whatever I say if it helps me. Oh, you mean like derail a prosecutorial investigation into Burisma in Ukraine? Would he do that?
Of course he would.
Yeah. Fascinating comments from Hunter. He also discussed his addiction to crack. And this is what he had to say about that.
You act as if drug addicts are the only one who come up with this idea that they're afraid, because if they don't continue their drugs, they're not going to have excuses. What a bunch of people know that they get in their car in the morning, and if they don't go to the gym, they're going to end up dying of obesity, but they don't go. Why? Because they're afraid. They're afraid that they're going to be thin and they're going to be healthy and be going to be able to engage in life more. And they don't have any excuses not to do that?
Well, it's a mixture of things. It's not.
But it's
habit,
just the same.
It's habit as well. It's habit.
And habit is the biggest thing that's happening here. The fact of the matter is that I have not had the fucking reason to break the ease of the habit I'm in. Mm-hmm. And the reason is because I don't, like what? Nothing has captured my imagination until now. Mm-hmm. And this. Mm-hmm. And that's why I have to start to do it. Because what I'm realizing now is this, is that my choice to do this, the drug, is brought me to an understanding and allowed me to break from everything in the past. Mm. Have you ever thought about this? Maybe this is the greatest thing that ever happened to me. Maybe this is literally the continuation and the continuum of what is going to be the thing that makes me the person that my father believes I am. My father believes I am. Everybody says the person my father thinks I'll never become. For me, it's the person I know.
He sounded like his dad there.
In the immortal words of Peter Cetera in Chicago, this is paraphrasing what Hunter Biden said about crack. Being without you takes a lot of getting used to. Should learn to live with it, but I don't want to because it's the hardest habit to break. Until my dad gets made point man for Eastern European policy, for Chinese communist policy by President Obama, and now we can start to cash some checks. Now I got a reason to get off the rocks. It's a wonderful rags-to-riches story, isn't it?
He needs help. I mean, I know addiction's hard to break.
He's bootstrapping.
He's really not embracing it either. These people, who do they think they are? Royalty?
You just heard it.
He's God.
He is God, or more to the point, Gob to his arrestedly developed family, I guess. Matt, Mount Greenwood, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. I met Kathleen Buell. I knew her brother, and when Biden was running against Obama years back, we reluctantly went to a fundraiser up on River North.
Mm-hmm.
Biden was talking about his Catholic-Irish heritage. That's another story, but Kathleen was saying it to us, telling our group, and we went reluctantly, believe me, but nonetheless, Kathleen was telling us that old Joe, he's not a wealthy man. He's just a hard-working guy who's worked very hard to get where he's at. And we started laughing at her. You're delusional. You have no idea what this guy's doing. And she was, I truly believe that in her mind, she thought he was just old Joe who worked hard to get what he has. And he's not even a millionaire. I'll never forget that. It was literally one of the most interesting nights of my life. But she was delusional. And her brother even admitted to it.
Hold on, Matt. Yeah. So she was married to Hunter at the time, right? So she was full on drinking the Kool-Aid.
Oh, 100%, Dan, 100%. And another interesting thing, I met Joe that night, and he said, you know, he was talking about this, about 100 guys, both the guys from the board of trade and the Merck. And he says, You know, I'm all very proud of my Irish Catholic heritage, and you knew old man Daly and this, that, and everything else. And I had to go take a break, get out, get some fresh air, so I didn't get any stupid on me. And I'm outside, and I knew it was Secret Service season, and here comes Biden, walks up to me, and he said, "How you doing, son?" And I said, "Well, I'm not your son, but it's good to see you, Mr. Biden." Give due respect at the time. And I said, "Let me ask you a question, if I may." He was, "Where are you from?" I said, "I live on the south side of Chicago." "That's great, blah, blah, blah." And I said, "Can I ask you a question?" He said, "Sure." He says, I said, "How do you, you know, you tell your Catholic-Irish heritage?" He goes, "Absolutely." I said, "How can you be for abortion?" And the Secret Service agent grabbed me, put that big, ugly smile in front of me. The Secret Service agent grabbed me and escorted away from me before he could answer. He wouldn't have had an answer, but he was escorted away from me nonetheless. And told me everything I needed to hear.
That's great. Was Hunter in attendance?
Yes, he was.
Really?
Yeah, but I didn't know who he was at the time.
Yeah. Oh, that's too bad. You could have, I mean, maybe you could have partied with him in Chicago, you know.
I'll throw him in the river.
Hey.
Matt, thanks for the call. Appreciate it. That's fun. Yeah, because Kathleen Buell's a Chicago native, isn't
that's
she?
That's right. Oh, she went to New Trier, I believe. Hold on. No. Is she from DuPage County? No. Don't you love listening to me type, Kathleen?
Yeah. Well, you get you and your crack staff get on that. We'll find out where she went to school. Frank in Arlington Heights.
Hey, good morning. I'm back from the free state of Florida, so I'll say hello. And, you know, Dan, when you and I were younger, there was a movie that played on the cable all the time during the summer, one of the summers, like 87 or 88. It was called Morgan Stewart's Coming Home. Do you remember that movie at all?
John Cryer.
Yeah, John Cryer. Yeah, he was in that. This whole situation with Hunter is like a alternative negative version of what happened in that movie versus, you know, what really happened in that movie was, you know, it was positive. They all came together as a family and they helped each other. But, I mean, this is like an alternative ending to that.
Yeah. So,
and then I wanted to ask you one more thing. Do you think, let's assume for a minute that Biden is actually senile. Let's make that assumption and game this out. What is the possibility that Biden is doing a lot of this stuff to jettison the nut jobs in his party and be in a situation like Clinton was and Obama was in 94 or 2010, where they don't have to deal with the nuts in their party and then can make a comeback in the next 2 years? Is that a possibility that he's doing that?
I think that sort of strategic thinking is beyond his capacity, and I don't think it has anything to do with whether or not he's senile. I think that sort of thinking was beyond his capacity when he was 30, number one. Number two is I don't see how that actually happens, because the energy in that party will remain with the socialist Spice Girls and their, you know, their ilk. So even though the caucus will shrink, it will actually get more radical. And frankly, you've seen some of this already happening with moderate Democrats being taken out, whether in primaries or potentially like yesterday in Texas in the Rio Grande, with a Republican winning that special election in a district that I think is like 80% Latino. So
84%.
Yeah.
I mean,
so
I just want to get your thoughts on that. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Thanks for the call, Frank. No, I think you're going to see a party that is, to borrow the, or to paraphrase the immortal words of General Honoré from Katrina, is stuck on socialism, which is sort of a proxy for stuck on stupid, but they're stuck on socialism. I don't think that's going to change even when they get, you know, a beat down in November.
Dan, I have your answer. Kathleen Buell
went to which high school?
St. Ignatius.
I've heard of it.
Yes, at Juggernaut on Roosevelt.
Oh, yeah. Another proud
small school.
Another impressive St. Ignatius graduate.
Yes.
Yeah. When's she coming back to give the commencement? Holy cow.
I don't know. Well, coming up on Chicago's Morning Answer.
All right. We've heard enough from Hunter. Now let's hear from the big guy at 6:06.
And later, I want to thank a man who saved me yesterday in the heat when my hobo ride broke down in the middle of Hubbard in Orleans. Not fun stuff, but thanks to him. I'll just say his name now. His name is Louie. And thank you, Louie. He sat me in his car, Dan, and he was listening to a different station, so I changed this station to our station.
Always be closing.
Always, yeah, because he goes, "I hope you don't mind my radio station. I know you're a city girl." And I said, "I'm a Republican." He's like, "You can sit in my car as long as you want. Wait for your tow truck to come." So But now he's going to be listening to 890, or I'm sorry, 560.
All right. Oh, he's decoding for the wrong station.
Yes.
Now try 560. Yeah. No. Okay. Thank you.
AM 560. You know, The Answer.
Yeah, I've heard of it.
Yes.
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560. The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560. The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. Hey, all of you domestic terrorists who've been attending school board meetings to express your thoughts on curriculum choices and COVID policies over the last year or more. Hey, listen up, you domestic terrorists. The Biden administration wants to work with you.
Oh, they know they're extending an olive branch? I'll tell my friends.
Yesterday, the Department of Education launched the National Parents and Families Engagement Council in a move to ensure parents can, quote, constructively participate in their children's education and, quote, facilitate, quote, strong and effective relationships between schools and families. Why would you want to facilitate a strong relationship between the heroes that run these schools and the domestic terrorists that dare question their choices? I don't understand. The council will consist of parent, family, or caregiver representatives from national organizations that will work with the DOE to identify constructive ways to help families engage at the local level. Miguel Cardona, who said last year, graciously, I thought.
Yes.
Graciously conceded that parents are one of the stakeholders in their child's education, which was a wonderful concession.
I mean, what are they going to take field trips to school board meetings and now sit here? Now's the time to talk. Oh, you're talking too loud.
Miguel Cardona saying parents are a child's first teachers until they're forced to turn them over to the state-sponsored teachers. That was my parenthetical remark. He didn't say that. Parents are a child's first teachers, and there is no one better equipped to work with schools and educators to identify what students need to recover. Recover from what? Recover from what?
Lockdowns that they put us in. What are they?
Wait a second. What do you mean? What are you talking about? That was for everybody's best interest. There's a recovery from that? The National Parents and Families Engagement Council will serve as an important link between families, caregivers, education advocates, and their school communities. This whole, you know, response, or even though it's Orwellian in nature, it has the same ring of Dr. Vivek Murthy's Ministry of Truth over at the Surgeon General's office. This is a concession, not about parents being important, not about parents being the primary stakeholder in their kids' education and their kids' lives. This is a concession that what you have done, you out there who have been active at the school board level, at the school level, that it's working, that it is taking a political toll on the Democrat socialists and their teachers' unions, teacher union financiers. Mm-hmm. And this is a response. This is a direct response to the revolt against the education establishment in this country. So good for you. 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line, 64636-DA, turnkey.pro text line.
And here in Chicago, you're not going to get any parental rights back next year. They announced yesterday, real quick, this ancillary issue, but it's about parents' control of their children, that next year they're going to do testing in schools for COVID. For example, yesterday we have 146 CPS kids that have COVID. No one's hospitalized, no serious cases. But yet 2,786 couldn't go to their last day of school. Some couldn't go to their graduation, another life experience missed because of these stupid quarantines. And they're going to continue, folks, next year. And here's the plan.
And what I see for the next school year is the majority of our schools being on a test-to-state pilot. So we're putting in the systems in place now. Whenever we quarantine children, it really is always for the safety of those students. Most of them are, you know, very close contacts. Some of them even have the start of symptoms.
That's just not true. And they kept saying yesterday during this press conference, it's so important to have kids in school. That's, you know, Mayor Lightfoot. That's my number one priority. Well, then keep kids in school and don't do this don't test healthy kids during school. If my kid's sick, I'll take them to the doctor. But again, we're going to have no parent control. So if parents don't want their child vaccinated or tested on a weekly basis, what are their rights? And they don't know. We don't have the rights. We have to give up the rights to the school.
Well, there are always outliers, and the school districts in big urban centers are the outliers when it comes to the parental revolt. And you see that with the imperious responses you get from people like Pedro Martinez that you were just listening to. So it's up to parents. And we've said that from the beginning. It's up to parents. It's up to parents on COVID policies. It's up to parents on grooming curriculum. It's up to parents. You should expect support from political leaders if you select the right ones, but don't expect them to do all of the heavy lifting for you. They won't. You have to engage at the local level. They can't run every local school district for you. And this is yet another opportunity that what DOA has done here, what the Biden administration is signaling here, as I said, is an indication that they are feeling the pressure and the blowback from the characterization of concerned parents being characterized as domestic terrorists, the blowback from culturally responsive teaching, training, and curricula in places like Illinois, the blowback from tampons in the boys' room, the blowback from white kids are racists and black kids are victims. They're feeling the blowback from parents helping to amplify what is going on in the schools and pressing school board members and administrators to change their ways, including, by the way, with recalls in San Francisco and a doubling of the number of incumbent school board members who have been turned out of office in the spring election so far nationally.
You know,
they're feeling it.
Well, the Democrats are running scared right now.
So keep it up. Keep it up.
But Pedro Martinez will say that you know, so there's 515 CPS schools. Only 40 have a test to stay program. And he said he's going to expand that, but just eliminate it. We don't need to have it. Because he's saying that while Mayor Lightfoot is talking about, the importance, you've got to be in school. Studies have shown.
Some of you know I have fought night and day, tirelessly, to make sure that our students get back to in-person learning and connected to this learning, because I know, and COVID-19 data showed, that school was the best and safest place for our students.
Then why keep students out? Again, 2,786. Think about that number. Could not go to school yesterday on the last day of school, and they were healthy children.
Yeah, well, she also...
And nobody cares.
She also folded in with the lockdowns when they were in effect.
She did, yes.
But this is what you're going to get from politicians like Triple Threat. You're going to get a gaslighting of what occurred over the last 2 years. They're now going to give you the sort of statement of principle of kids need to be in school and don't pay any attention to what I did during the pandemic or,
right,
frankly, since the pandemic, because I don't think the Rona busters have conceded the pandemic is over. So this is an opportunity, the opportunity for revolt against the education establishment, if you will. I mean, these Marxists in charge of CPS is what I'm talking about. That will come in February and April of next year.
312-642-5600, turnkey.pro. Answer line 64636. Type in DA, then a quick comment. Because I know a lot of eighth graders graduated yesterday, and there are a lot who are not going to Chicago Public Schools. And that's in part because some of them didn't get into selective enrollment school, but they're done with the CTU. Because there's going to be another strike in 2 more years. You know that there will be when their contract's up. And they're just sick of living like this. And good
right.
for them. They have the rights because then they can decide, should I vaccinate my kid or do I have to vaccinate my kid in order to go to this school?
The conversation about school districts like CPS and so many more school districts around this state and around the country. You know, per our discussion for much of last week about the reporting that the research and reporting that WirePoints did on math and reading scores at the third grade level in mid-sized urban districts around the state of Illinois, the conversation about CPS and those districts is the same conversation about the state of Illinois. Revolt or bolt. Either take the opportunities when they present themselves to reorder those systems and remove the current leadership or leave. There's no in between. That truly is a binary. It's one or the other. I mean, obviously you have the third choice, which is to stay. But if you stay, then you know exactly what you're going to get, and don't feign surprise because nobody is buying it. Everybody sees what's going on. If you have two eyes and a room temperature IQ, everybody sees it. What are you going to do? Revolt or bolt? From CPS, from the Decatur schools, from the Rockford government schools, from many of the suburban school districts. I'd put places like Naperville 203 at the top of the list with the performance we saw from that school board and that superintendent during the pandemic.
Horrible.
And by the way, remember here, the battle has been joined because of the parental revolt. Keep it up, because resources are coming to support parents who want to hold themselves up for school board to replace COVIDian school board members, Marxist school board members, I repeat myself, imposing these sexualized curricula on kids, this racist curricula on kids. The resources are coming, and I'm not talking about from Biden's Department of Education. I'm talking about electorally to change out the leadership and oversight of these schools. So keep the pressure up.
And it just still makes
sense. And come the winter, even in Chicago, you have a choice for mayor. And right now you have a choice. I mean, the choice is Paul Vallis right now, if you want to change the trajectory of the Chicago public schools, if you want to change the culture within the Chicago schools. Then right now, Paul Vallis is the clear choice for mayor. So you have a chance again.
And he supports parents who go to and speak in front of school board meetings. He and I did a lot of rallies together and promoted candidates who were running in certain districts. And to think that the parents who went to fight for their children were labeled terrorists by the Biden administration should sicken you.
I hope Paul Vallis isn't the only one. It should be a chorus. Whether it's the current crop of candidates or an expanded field, it shouldn't be just Paul Vallis being the lone voice on these issues of completely reimagining the Chicago public school system from the Soviet Politburo form of organization it currently takes.
Well, I think he is. I mean, what I've been hearing from other candidates who, you know, every day they, not every day, but about once a week they're coming forward. Jamal Green was featured yesterday. You know, he's going to return to the Harold Washington, you know, root grassroots.
I'm talking about serious candidates. I'm not talking about Jamal Green. I'm talking about candidates that have a chance to win.
No, all I hear them talk about is crime. That's their number one priority, which, yes, we need help with the violence problem in Chicago. But I haven't heard any plans for CPS or doing anything with CPS.
Joe, Arlington Heights.
Good morning. Let's not leave out local media. If we're going to have this, if there is a revolt or bolt dynamic occurring, it'll be aided or it'll be retarded by the local media. And that's true on a national basis as well, whether we're talking about Caterpillar and why companies are leaving. The media lets Pritzker tell his lies about how Chicago's how Illinois is growing. And the same is true with other than Amy Jacobson, people with a press pass get in these rooms, whether it's with Lightfoot or anyone else locally or on the state level, and they're afraid to challenge people. And that's really a terrible phenomenon
afraid.
About the culture of Chicago.
They're not afraid. They're in bed with. It's different.
Okay, better yet. Yes, absolutely. They've drunk the Kool-Aid or they're corrupt. They either believe.
There's a lot of laziness out there, too, folks.
Thanks for the
they're
call,
just lazy.
Joe.
They don't ask questions where they can.
Well, right. They're
and
intellectually lazy.
And I'm not talking
lazy.
About Craig Waller, Marian Ahern. I think they're great.
Yeah,
and,
okay.
Well, at least they're there and they're asking questions.
They're intellectually lazy, which is one way of being in bed with the political ruling class. That's not an excuse, and it certainly doesn't prevent them from being a useful idiot for the political ruling class, which many of them are. So that doesn't, you know, provide any mitigation for their performance. The good news is Nobody reads these papers anymore. Nobody watches appointment television under the age of 70. The local news is going the way of the newspapers, the daily newspapers like the AFL-CIO, NPR Times, and the Tribune, for the same reason. Doesn't have context or consequence to people's lives. So the good news is that the Chicago press corps is less and less relevant. If you have the resources and a quality message, then you can work around and through the remnants of the old media. It's getting better. Keep it up. Dan and Amy, Chicago's Morning Answer.
This is the morning show. More Chicago radio listeners are choosing. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560. The Answer. Only the biggest stories, only the biggest guests, and only the biggest opinions. This is AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. Time for a little bit of Midwest farmer common sense. Blake Hurst is a corn, soybean, and greenhouse farmer, former president of the Missouri Farm Bureau.
For 10 years.
And he recently penned a piece in the Wall Street Journal about the prospective student loan forgiveness plan being bandied about by the Democrat Socialists in D.C., starting with the big guy that's pending, although there has been some student loan forgiveness. And when we say student loan forgiveness, that's a euphemism for debt shifting from people who incurred the debt to people who did not. That's what it is. Student loan forgiveness. You know, it's just forgiven. You just wave it away. No, you just shift the cost to people who didn't make the choice to incur the debt. That's what you're actually doing. Is that fair? Well, let's ask Blake Hurst. Blake Hurst, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Good to be here.
So the debt shifting, as I'm describing, makes your grandson a chump. That's what you wrote in the Wall Street Journal. Explain.
Well, he's worked very hard since he was pretty darn young. I described in the article about how his mother would rust him out of bed when we have snow here in northwest Missouri, deliver him to town. They live about 3 miles outside of town, and he and his sister would walk up and down streets offering to shovel sidewalks. He's worked for our family business on every spare minute and weekends, summer vacations, and during high school has been work construction, and this summer is also working as a box carrier at a fireworks stand. So the kid has worked very hard. He's earned a lot of scholarships, and he's put together, according to his mom, enough money to pay his way through college.
And he's attending Iowa State University, right?
Yeah, he's going to be an ag engineer, at least he hopes to. We'll see how calculus one goes, but he's a good student. I think he'll succeed because he knows how to work, and I think he'll succeed in whatever he puts his mind to.
Yeah, and so he's paying his way through college, so he's all set. So what's the big deal if the federal government comes in and says those people who incur debt to pay their way through college don't have to pay it back?
Well, for people who have existing loans, they made an agreement. They agreed to take the money, to rent the money, and to use it to pay their further education, which is a wonderful thing. But they also made an agreement to pay it back, and now they're saying, well, it's hard, and we shouldn't have to. But life is hard, and that's what we've tried to, Aaron's parents have tried to teach him, that life demands work and dedication. And now what he's learned is that if he just takes out loans, he'll probably be forgiven, because this certainly won't be a one-off. It won't be a one-time thing. It'll have to be permanent, because that's the way politics works. And all that work, you know, he's still earned the money, and he'll be able to spend the money on other things. But that goal is no longer – he no longer has the satisfaction of having paid his own way. And that, I think, is the road to whatever kind of happiness we can have in this unhappy world, is sort of an earned success, working toward a goal and reaching that goal because of your own work and and brains and just getting up early and doing it. And all at once we're telling kids that, nah, you don't really have to do that, or at least not for another 5 or 6 years. You don't really need to enter the real world of work and accomplishment till much, much later. And I think that's a bad signal to send.
Is he expecting, though, to be part of a college loan forgiveness program? I mean, is that what he sees in the future?
Well, I think so. I mean, again, how are you going to do it one time? And believe me, the first reaction of every college in the country will be to raise tuition, because if there's all at once $10,000 guaranteed if you use the Biden plan, or $50,000 in loan relief that Senator Warren and Bernie Sanders would like to give students, if you do that once, you can't hardly say, well, yeah, that was only for kids that were in school in 2022. But if you're in college in 2023, you're on your own. That's just not going to happen. And I think it's just naive to think that it won't be permanent.
Yeah, we spoke with a gentleman yesterday on our program who just quit a job at some college. He was a student affairs advisor, academic advisor. He was disappointed by the environment at college. You know, he went to college. He got his master's degree in student affairs management or some such thing. Then his first job at 23 was working as an academic advisor at some college. And he was underpaid, so he said. He was undervalued. He worked too hard. He had to work 60 hours a week some weeks. And he didn't feel safe because the benefits package wasn't generous enough because of the 60 hours of work week, because he was undervalued, so he says. Cool. It was really interesting because I think people don't appreciate this real break, this real generational break in attitude towards work and, as you said, earned success. It is very real. And you have some politicians promoting this idea, as you were just describing, that, you know, life doesn't have to be hard. As long as you're a serf of the state, I wonder how much you see that mentality manifesting itself, particularly within like your grandson's friend circles, and whether he is an outlier, or at least where you are, most of his friends, because of their families, have the same understanding of work that you do.
I think, you always have to be careful. trying to discern what other people think, but I think we're really far behind in Northwest Missouri. It's a small town, it's a farming community, and the kids typically do have jobs. In our greenhouse business, we hire, oh gosh, six or eight kids. I will say probably it's harder to find kids to come and work than it was 10 years ago. But we still find good kids. Mm-hmm. And it's usually, I always would say that we let the work sort them out. By that I mean, we never have to ask them to leave or anything. They just don't show up the third day when they find out it really is hard work. Mm-hmm. But we're still able to find that core of young people that will work. But I see, and I don't know that it's an attitude shift on the kids' part as much as their parents just don't push them maybe like they did 20 or 50 years ago. And they're financially able to do that, partially, I suppose, because of student loans. And so I do see, you know, we're having more trouble than we probably did 5 or 10 years ago. But the attitude I don't see. They usually are pretty good help once we get in there and they stay.
Yeah. Now, Mr. Hurst, are you offering signing bonuses for people to work in your greenhouse? Because that's what they're trying to do here, to get people to work anywhere.
No, we're not, and we may have to do that. We do, however, get bonuses. It's a seasonal work, and so we always, if they make it through the whole spring, we're going to give them a bonus. So that's always how we've handled that, but we may have to change. I don't know.
Do you have a spa, dry cleaning services on site? You know, the other amenities that make that 40-hour work week tolerable?
Video games.
No, I'm afraid you're going to work in a very hot greenhouse and you have 30 at the end of the day. So, right. Yeah, sorry.
All right. Just speaking of farming, and let's talk a little bit about food prices. Just be interesting yep. to get your perspective. The report out last week from a lot of the big food companies, from Tyson to Kraft to the big snack food companies, Hormel Foods, et cetera, Campbell Soup, all saying, get ready for another round of price hikes because of the cost of doing business, the inputs into our business. Where do you see? And we had this farmer, had a significant farm in Iowa who was on Tucker Carlson's show about a month ago, and he was saying, you're looking at, and that was about a dollar and a half ago in terms of the price at the pump. Oh, yeah. But he said, you're looking at a few hundred bucks extra at the pump every month. Wait till food costs you, your groceries cost you an extra $1,000 a month, because that's coming. And it seems like he was prescient, because we're seeing that happening and we're seeing that trend line right now.
Yeah, it's frightening. One of the things that typically happens when we see that, we've obviously got really strong prices in corn and soybeans, the things I raise, wheat as well. But typically that happens because of something that's happened in agriculture. We've had a dry year. We don't produce as much, the price goes up. As you know, when you buy bread at the store, very little of the cost of that bread is in the wheat. But now we're seeing not only the increase in the price of the wheat, which may only be 20% or less of the cost of a loaf of bread, but the transportation costs are going up, the packaging costs are going up, the labor costs are going up. Everything has gone up at once. And so I think we're probably not, have not seen the end of increases in price of food. And I don't see a very rapid way out of this problem. So we've always taken for granted that we're going to have what we want, where we want it, and at a price we can afford when we go to the grocery store. For a little while here, that may not be true. So it is a little bit, it's frightening. It surely is.
In addition to cost, just your personal experience or those of your colleagues, especially since you were the head of the Farm Bureau there in Missouri, or is it Missouri? Am I pronouncing it right?
I say Missouri, but most of my neighbors say Missouri.
All right. Go either way. All right. What about, do you still have, are you having, or colleagues of yours, other farmers having issues getting product to market?
Well, it's difficult to find supplies. Yes. We worried very early on this year about a lot of the inputs we use to raise crops. Now I was able, so far, been able to secure everything I needed. For the greenhouse business, it's actually been a real issue. We've not been able to get things we needed. We've had to cancel orders that we had for product because we couldn't find the inputs. And of course, costs are just crazy.
Things like fertilizer?
Fertilizer's, almost in some instances definitely is doubled, and in some instances tripled. Still can get it, and then shipping has been such an issue. We're spending last year I got a container of just pots for the greenhouse, and the shipping was $20,000. Totally unexpected.
Normally
it's figured in the cost of the pot. Literally the pots cost $50,000 last year. This year, the pots cost $60,000, and the shipping was $20,000.
Oh my!
And I had no way to budget for that. And it was, and I'm promised it again.
You know what they need? You know what you need? You need a pot forgiveness program.
There you go, Dan.
I do.
Committee hearing and everything. Yeah. Meetings.
Yeah. but it's really been it's been a challenge, and people, of course. As always, people are buying ahead and doing all the things that whether it be toilet paper during the pandemic or farm supplies now, people are buying ahead and hoarding and all those things. So it's going to be a while before this works through the system and we'll get back to normal.
We have, it's more likely than not here in Illinois that we're going to have a nominee for governor in the Republican Party who's a farmer from Southern Illinois. Do you think a farmer from someplace like Southern Illinois, not that far from Missouri, could be the chief executive of a state like Illinois when we have so many cosmopolitan sophisticates in Chicago who have demonstrated, you know, that they know how things should be done to enjoy a robust state that attracts people and businesses. What do you think about the prospect of a farmer being the governor of Illinois?
Well, he'll, I think would be a good choice simply because of the experience of working working with nature and working with in an industry where it's hard to predict the future. That seems to me to be a lot like politics, and maybe you know, a farmer would adopt policies and laws that would have kept Caterpillar, which is a very important industry to farmers, would have kept it in your state. Who knows?
Indeed. Blake Hurst, corn, soybean, and greenhouse farmer, former president of the Missouri Farm Bureau. Blake Hurst, thanks so much for joining us. Appreciate it.
You bet. Thank you. Appreciate it.
It was a pleasure. Thank you. And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
Listen to Dan and Amy on your smartphone. Download the AM560 mobile app today at 560theanswer.com/mobile. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy, the pro-abort political violence attendant to the run-up to the Supreme Court's Dobbs decision, which will be released
soon, right?
Perhaps today, but certainly by the end of the month. That's the end of the term. Lila Rose from Live Action tweeting over the weekend, this weekend pro-abortion activists firebombed a pregnancy center in Gresham, Oregon, which provided material help for mothers and children. Imagine if this had been an abortion clinic. It would be headline news, but because it's pro-life center, media and the Biden administration ignore, and the Department of Justice, too. I would be more specific than just the Biden administration. Sure, the big guy ignores it, but so does the law enforcement arm of the federal government, which is sort of a problem. Our friends at Catholic Vote, Brian Birch and Company, tracking the number of incidents of this pro-abortion political violence since the Dobbs draft opinion was leaked. 23 incidents of political violence in the last several weeks since that opinion was leaked. And you wouldn't know it, of course, to consume the pap from the D.C. press corps. A campaign of fire and broken glass, James Freeman writes in his Best of the Web column at the Wall Street Journal. Just because media outlets downplay a threat doesn't mean law enforcement should. And, of course, we're talking about 24 incidents of political violence, family groups, offices being vandalized, threats being made, firebombing a crisis pregnancy center, and, oh, by the way, an assassination plot against Brett Kavanaugh.
Right.
Have we forgotten about that?
Yeah, well, the DC press corps barely talked about it.
The DC press corps is trying to make you forget about it. Even the, generally speaking, left-leaning U.S. bishops pleading for an end to violence following the ongoing attacks on Catholic churches and pro-life pregnancy centers. Cardinal Timothy Dolan, New York, Archbishop William Laurie of Baltimore, in light of the violence, we urge our elected officials to take a strong stand against this violence and our law enforcement authorities to increase their vigilance in protecting those who are in increased danger. The U.S. bishops have tracked 139 church attacks since 2020, a number that has increased significantly since the May 2nd leak of the Supreme Court draft opinion, as we were just describing. Charities that support pregnant mothers in need have been firebombed, and pro-life organizations have been attacked almost daily and terrorized. Oh, yes. The Marxists who are in the business of saving lives and protecting the rights of women, so they say. For more on all of this and the run-up to the Dobbs decision, pleased to be joined by Amy Gerke, who is the president of Illinois Right to Life. Amy, thanks for being with us. Appreciate it.
Oh, thanks so much for having me on.
What about this political violence that has occurred over the last 6 weeks specifically? You could expand beyond that if you want, like the U.S. bishops did over the last couple of years. But the last 6 weeks specifically and the response from media and law enforcement combined.
Well, it's shocking, but not surprising. This is, I've been working in the pro-life movement for over 30 years, and this is definitely one of the more frightening times for pro-life advocates. The way that it's been completely ignored by the media and, you know, even more amazingly by law enforcement at the highest levels of our government is absolutely shocking. And it's really quite a contrast to back in the 1990s. I was working in the pro-life movement full-time in Washington, D.C., and as you might recall, tragically, all those years ago, there was a spate of violence against abortion clinics by extremist pro-life advocates, which, of course, the pro-life movement condemned. Were a movement of peace and wanting to protect everybody. And the response from the media was quite different than it is now. We spent hours upon hours on the phone with reporters discussing it and explaining that the pro-life movement does not endorse violence. And, you know, seeing how it's completely being ignored today just illustrates what a complete double standard there is when it comes to the pro-life movement.
Oh, yeah.
It's really, yeah.
I remember very well. You would have thought Eric Rudolph was Phyllis Schlafly the way that those incidents were covered. And yeah, I mean, I don't know what is unclear about the position of from conception to natural death. That is a pretty blanket statement in support of the defense of life, and that is the position of the pro-life movement. I wonder if you and other pro-life leaders around the country with whom you speak are concerned that we could see the summer of 2020 repeated in 2022. It was Black Lives Matter in 2020. It could be the pro-abortion radicals this summer.
Well, they've said that they're planning a summer of rage, which, you know, is really not surprising considering that abortion is an act of incredible violence against the most innocent members of the human family. So we are definitely concerned. We are taking precautions. You know, I'm taking precautions to make sure my team is protected. You know, we've been concerned speaking with our local friends at Pregnancy Resource Centers, hearing some of the threats that they've received. At Illinois Right to Life, we've received some just kind of disgusting and childish phone calls, nothing that we would consider dangerous. But, you know, life people who are in this full time are really watching out for ourselves, watching out for our friends, and encouraging everybody who's pro-life to, you know, keep an eye out. This is definitely a time for celebration. We're on the brink possibly of Roe versus Wade being overturned, and this is of course what we've been working towards for almost 50 years. So this is definitely a time to be happy and to celebrate, but also a time to be cautious.
Yeah, I mean, Governor Pritzker even said at one of his press conferences recently that, yeah, this is going to be, there's going to be riots in the streets with this Dobbs decision coming down. But speaking of Governor Pritzker, I remember it was around Christmas time that he signed a bill letting the parental notification law expire. And I remember no media being there.
No, he signed the repeal of parental notice of abortion, which was passed late at night during the veto session. He signed that on a Friday afternoon, the Friday before Christmas, with no media present. And, you know, Friday afternoon is when politicians do stuff when they want absolutely no attention whatsoever. And, I mean, it's no surprise that he was trying to hide this. Parental notice was a very popular law. It was supported by over 70% of Illinois voters, including 58% who identified as pro-choice. So, you know, repealing parental notice of abortion wasn't something he did to please the voters. It was definitely something he did to please his friends in the abortion industry.
And he said that he did it because, you know, of incest. And how many cases of incest are there? Do we even know in Illinois?
Well, actually, Governor Pritzker said from day one when the whole parental notice of abortion debate ensued that it was important to repeal parental notice to protect girls who were victims of sexual abuse and incest, et cetera, like you said. And that is just completely false. Our parental notice law had a blanket waiver that exempted girls who stated in writing that they were victims of abuse. So, you know, I hate to call Governor Pritzker a liar, but he really, really clouded the issue and there was absolutely no reason for parental notice to be repealed. He's, in fact, put our young girls in incredible danger by repealing this law.
Well, if the description fits, you feel free to use it. Here, you know, the other thing, too, on this, and I've seen some recent public polling on this because it moves around a bit. But, you know, where the majority of the country is, and I haven't seen recent polling in Illinois, but I'd suggest it's probably pretty close. The majority of the country on abortion is prohibition after heartbeat. That's where the majority of the country is. You wouldn't know it for the D.C. press corps. You would think that the majority of the country is for abortion on demand to the birth canal. But actually, that's fewer than 1 in 10 voters nationally who believe that. It is a extreme a minority, extreme in both in terms of size and in terms of ideology. And so so it seems to me there's real opportunity if there's additional courage demonstrated by pro-life leaders, which has been demonstrated by Illinois Right to Life for generations, but in it, but also pro-life voters to be leaders on this issue to say, look, we're right where the majority of the country is, a heartbeat and their prohibition. That would be incredible progress. I mean, getting notification back would be incredible progress, but ultimately working towards prohibition after heartbeat would be a great place for Illinois.
Absolutely. You know, one of the things, I've been in Illinois for about a year and a half now, and one of the things that I've discovered is that a vast majority of our population, including a lot of great pro-life people, have no idea how radical our laws are. And we have begun conducting polling that really bears this out and shows exactly what you said. We conducted polling in, you know, the deep blue western suburbs of Chicago. And even there, a majority was in favor of parental notice of abortion. They wanted the law still to be in place. And just as you said, a majority of them support reasonable restrictions on abortion. They do not support abortion through all 9 months of pregnancy. What so many Illinois voters don't understand is that our laws are completely out of step with mainstream public opinion on abortion. And, you know, Governor Pritzker in his time in office, you know, beyond repealing parental notice of abortion, through the Reproductive Health Act, he has done so much to make abortion, which is, of course, always deadly to preborn babies. He's made it so much more dangerous for the women of Illinois in an effort to protect the profits of the abortion industry.
Well, what about, well, how is the expiration of the parents' rights notification law? How is that going to increase human trafficking?
So here in Illinois, it's, you know, a well-known fact that, you know, this is one of the states that has a huge problem with human trafficking. And during the debate over this bill, over the repeal of parental notice of abortion, we heard from several women who work to help women escape human trafficking, including one woman, Dr. Brooke Bellow, who herself was trafficked and had several forced abortions. And she said that you are hard-pressed to find a woman who's been trafficked who has not had at least one forced abortion. The vast majority have had several forced abortions. So because Illinois is open for business for the abortion industry, basically any human trafficker, sexual predator, sexual abuser can bring their victims to Illinois for an abortion with nobody ever knowing. The only people that the repeal of parental notice protects are those that would benefit from a young girl's abortion. You know, again, the human traffickers, the sexual predators, et cetera.
And this is something that's going to be important to argue in the general election here in Illinois, because you know that the governor and the Democrats, pro-abort Democrat socialists, are going, assuming the Dobbs decision is what we expect, they're going to be pounding the drum saying, you know, we're standing for women and we're standing for women's rights. And they're going to try to make the campaign about abortion and guns, probably, because they can't make it about the economy or the education system.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And yeah, Illinois Right to Life and Illinois Right to Life Action are going to be working hard to make sure that the people of Illinois know the truth and that Governor Pritzker really, really clouds this issue. And, you know, moreover, he says that he trusts women and that he wants to fight for women. But, he has illustrated time and time again with the laws that he signed that he doesn't even respect women. So it's up to the pro-life people of Illinois to stand up and speak out and make sure everybody knows the truth.
She is Amy Gerke. She's the executive director of Illinois Right to Life. Amy, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Thanks so much.
Thank you. And she joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
It's what Chicago is talking about. It's Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan and Amy on AM 560, The Answer.
Sports and politics and sports and politics and sports and politics and intersection. Arrogance and ignorance, arrogance, ignorance, and arrogance and ignorance. Intersection.
Dan and Amy, good morning. Before we get to sports and politics, just a little politics quickly.
Yes, please.
Don't want to obsess on this, but I just want to update it since this came over the transom. Yeah. Robert Cahaley is the principal pollster at Trafalgar Group. They are not affiliated with any of the Republican gubernatorial candidates, to my knowledge. They did an independent poll on both the Senate race and the governor's race, the primaries here. On the governor's race, he just tweeted out, he has it 37.6% for Darren Bailey, 20% for Irvin, 12% for Sullivan, 8% for Rabine, 5% for Schimpf. So that is sort of directionally consistent with the polling and the way the race has been trending since I released a survey a couple of weeks back now that had Bailey up 7. Since then, he has been expanding his lead according to other polls that have been done in the interim and now according to the Trafalgar Group poll. Remember, Trafalgar Group was the only pollster that had Trump winning in 2016. They correctly had him winning Michigan and Pennsylvania. So a bit of a track record there in addition to just the aggregate number of polls that are giving you a snapshot in time, and the snapshot is that Bailey is ahead and he's extending.
And what about in the Senate race?
The Senate race right now is, according to the Trafalgar poll, a dead heat between Peggy Hubbard and Kathy Salvey. Okay. Peggy Hubbard at 17%, Kathy Salvey at 15%, the rest in single digits. So I'll take that for what it's worth. But now let's get to sports and politics, because the news out that Brittany Griner, the WNBA star, is going to be held in Russia till at least July 2nd.
Yeah, they extended her sentence for a third time.
That prompted Dan Dakich, who was a standout basketball player at Indiana, former head coach at the collegiate level and an analyst and podcaster now, to comment on this captivity at the hands of the Russian communists Brittany Griner is being subjected to and what our country is doing about it and how he thinks a previous administration would have handled this as compared to the current administration.
I mean, look, I get it. You want to detain her. You got strict laws. You're mad at the Americans. Okay, but we're talking about 4 months. And I got to tell you something. When Steve Alford took his UCLA team over there and that one little clown, Ball, and his buddies on the team went and got arrested for shoplifting in China, Trump got him out like within days. Mm-hmm. This is what I say. I said to other guys on OutKick, there was a respect/fear of the Trump administration. You may hate the Trump administration, and that's fine. That basically fueled the last election, that and a bunch of harvested votes, but that's fine. Look, if that's what you want to do, then you do you. But at least Trump understood and said, wait a second here. We're not taking our people. Hell, Obama, what did Obama do? Obama gave up a bunch of war criminals to get people out. Trump said, get our guys out. Get them out now. They got them out. Man, this weak-ass, dim-witted president that we got and his weak-ass, dim-witted, bought and sold buddies in politics can't get Brittany Griner out. Now, you guys tell me. Trump's the racist bad guy. This guy is down for the cause. Good guy. This guy hadn't done squat.
312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line, 646-36-DA, turnkey.pro text line. How do you like them apples?
Well, I mean, he's spot on. It's so true. Because what is the Biden administration doing? Nothing.
Have they commented on it?
No, I mean, they did say that the State Department's working on it because, you know, the State Department's in charge of making sure Americans are safe in foreign lands. But,
No, the President of the United States, as the chief executive, is responsible for making sure Americans are safe. The State Department is the instrumentality of the executive.
Right. Well, I'm just like, they said that they're working on it. But I don't feel like there's any, you know, fire under their feet to get anything done. Eventually they'll get to it. You know, just like inflation, just like the shortage of baby formula, now the shortage of tampons. You know, eventually we're always playing catch up with the Biden administration. We're never being proactive.
Yeah, and what, just, you know, just like Americans in Afghanistan and the withdrawal.
Yeah. That deadly withdrawal, which was disgusting, it could have been easily avoided.
And I thought Dakich's riff was great. And I mean, right, Trump is the racist bastard. He gets a ball and the UCLA kids out of harm's way in China when there was a dust up. You have a black female WNBA star, and not only is the Biden administration not saying very much. Where is the D.C. political press corps? Why isn't this an international incident? Putin is to blame for everything else, and we're taking a hard line with Putin, and we're not going to yield to Putin. And yet you have this woman being improperly detained, you know, with respect to anything that we resemble as due process, yeah, in Russia for months on end for a minor infraction. And we got unnamed State Department officials working on it. I'm sorry, that's not good enough. But I suppose it's consistent. I mean, you know, this is an administration and this is a party dominated by new Marxists that don't have much respect for due process in this country. So I suppose why should they have much respect for the lack of due process from Putin and the Russian communists?
312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line, 64636. Type in DA, then a quick comment.
Andy Hinsdale, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Yeah, you know, I've been thinking about this ever since she was detained because, you know, she is a Baylor alum. Our family's very involved with the school. Absolutely certain Trump would have had her out in a week or two. Based on his track record. But I think if this whole thing belies a fundamental misunderstanding about Trump that people hold, you know, I have a friend who did personal business dealings with him, and then based on seeing his history, reading books about him, he couldn't care less if you are a illegal alien Jewish lesbian who is 200 pounds overweight. If you're effective, If you could have a positive effect on his business, he hired you. He was all for you. It didn't matter whether she was a black lesbian basketball player or not. The fact that she was an American being detained illegally, right, he would have been effective at getting her out. And I think they just won't admit it.
Thanks for the call, Andy. I tend to agree, and even with the complication of Russia's invasion of Ukraine and our arming of the Ukrainians, I mean, you know how Trump is when he gets onto something. He's like a dog with a bone. And if he got onto this, and you know he would. Because this is celebrity oriented, this is a
right
star athlete, he would have been nonstop beating the drum for Brittany Griner. He would have dedicated time and resources to it. He would have tried to cut some deal with Putin and the Russian communists to get her out and then resume whatever the policy was.
There's no question about it. He'd use his platform on social media or when he was in front of the lectern, or have her partner or her wife or her family come to the Oval Office and talk to them. I mean, the State Department on Monday met with Griner's Phoenix Mercury teammates. Whoop-de-doo. But they let them know that, you know, we're working on this.
Yeah.
Like this smoke and mirrors. Okay.
This is something particularly because of the war in Ukraine, mm-hmm, per the Russian invasion. It is something that is particularly salient and should be addressed by the President of the United States. But it's not being. And Dakich going back and talking about turning over Taliban terrorists in exchange for Bo Bergdahl, right? I mean, it's just the weakness of the Obama administration, the 2 terms of Obama and the 2 years of Biden. There's no question about it. I don't think you can credibly argue in the alternative based on what we've seen. I wanted to get to something else, too. Speaking of consorting with the enemies, the LIV tour kicked off this past weekend. I'm not sure if they're hosting tournament events or golf outings.
It looks
Because first of all,
are they playing a scramble?
They're not playing a scramble, no, but there's a team component to it.
Right.
There's shotgun starts. I believe there are cash prizes for long drive and closest to the pin, but I'm not sure about that. I think there's a beer cart girl that drives around. No, I'm kidding about that stuff. But I mean, it sort of has the field. Right. I mean, and the money is just
insane.
Over the top.
It's insane.
Schwartzel won more money in that event he won over the weekend than he's won in like the last 6 years on the tour. But the more interesting aspect of this is the repudiation of those PGA pros who bucked the PGA for the Saudi-funded tour from the 9/11 families. Terry Strada wrote a letter to Mickelson, to Dustin Johnson, to DeChambeau, to Patrick Reed, to Kevin Na. As a freedom-loving America, I'm grateful to have the freedom of choice where I work and who I work for, and I respect your right as well. As a 9/11 widow, I feel compelled to help you understand the level of depravity the kingdom engaged in when it knowingly sent government agents here to establish the support network needed for those hijackers. As you may know, Osama bin Laden and 15 of the 19 September 11th hijackers were Saudis. It was the Saudis who cultivated and spread the evil, hate-filled Islamist ideology that inspired the violent jihadists to carry out the deadly 9/11 attacks. And most egregiously, it is the kingdom that has spent 20 years in denial, lying about their activities and cowardly dodging the responsibility they bear. Yet these are your partners, and much to our disappointment, you appear to be pleased to be in business with them.
I just don't want to
watch.
Yeah, because President Biden's going to Saudi Arabia in July, you know, after he called them on the campaign trail a pariah.
Well, he was going to make them a pariah state. That's what his commitment was. Now he's going there to meet with MBS hat in hand because he needs more oil to prop up the political prospects for the Democrat socialists. But I got to tell you, if I was Mickelson, Johnson, I would not want to be in bed with the MBS and the Saudis. I wouldn't want to be in bed with somebody as weak as Joe Biden, who says one thing and does 180 degrees the other.
It's just
thing.
So weird because Mickelson and the others are getting criticized for, you know, teaming up with them. And then who's holding Biden accountable for going over there? Because, you know, they say that he's going over there to repair relations. And now he's going to try to convince them to pump more oil.
The American people are going to hold Joe Biden accountable. That's who's going to hold them accountable. There's no double standard here in terms of the condemnation of what these tour pros have done and what Biden has done, or at least not from this quarter. The 9/11 families, the 9/11 victims' families, mm-hmm. suggesting that these PGA tour pros have sold them out. So, yeah, it's your right. You can make the choice. Nobody's saying it's illegal, but it is not laudable. Is it? And by the way, Mickelson, here we go too. Mickelson's such a mess on this issue. He apologized to the 9/11 families. Well, it's like that press conference he had last week. Well, what are you apologizing for? If there's nothing wrong with what you're doing, what are you apologizing for? Lewis on the South Side.
Good morning, Dan. Good morning, Amy. About Brittany Gaynor.
Greiner.
Where's it? Gaynor.
Greiner.
Where's...
Say it right.
Okay. Okay. We'll get
we
it
got
right.
One, we already got one name assassinator on this
Thank
show.
You.
We don't need two, Lewis.
Well, you can have diversity in that assassination, though.
All
okay.
Right.
Okay. Where's the LGBTQT about, you know, helping her, you know, because she is married to a woman. And then, Amy, about that tampon shortage, all they have to do is look in the Chicago boys' bathrooms.
There are some.
We have right. enough in there.
There you go. Thanks for the call, Lewis. Bob, Edison Park.
Yeah, guys, you know, I'm so glad the light of this Saudi – I'm not a golfer, but the fact that Saudi Arabia is basically going to try to take over the PGA or professional golf is bringing so much attention to this issue about outsourcing America. My only question is this should have started 60, 70 years ago. I mean, everything from Nike gym shoes to – iPhones to everything else with China. Why doesn't it, you know, we're complaining about the a handful of golf pros, but yet we care nothing about these corporations, these American corporations, which have sold out to the Chinese for how long? And I guarantee you, as evil as Saudi Arabia is, and they are, China is a far greater threat. I mean, they own our entertainment.
I get it. Yeah, you're right. China is a much greater threat to the United States than the Saudis are. I get that. But that's not the point. And it's also not the point that, you know, where were we doing this and where were we doing that? I mean, you can raise those questions. We're doing it now. And so let's address what we can do in real time since we don't have a time machine. And what we can do in real time is challenge the NBA for being in bed with the Chinese communists and challenge Hunter Biden and challenge Fortune 500 companies. And we can challenge PGA tours that are getting in bed with MBS and the Saudis, too.
But I honestly, Dan, and I agree with you, but I don't see the challenge to these Fortune 500 companies. I really don't. I don't see the challenge. I mean, I see occasionally there's a story or this or that or an op-ed, but really, is there real pushback? I don't see it, but I hope you're right.
Thanks for the call, Bob. Well, I mean, there was pushback policy-wise from the Trump administration in particular, which is why you saw so many companies moving their supply chains in the Far East from China to places like Vietnam. That's number one, which technically is still a communist country, but it right. doesn't quite operate like the Chinese do. Also the onshoring that was going on because of the supply chain breakages in the pandemic. So, you know, sometimes companies have to learn big corporations in particular have to learn the hard way. And sometimes it takes time for the light bulb to go on, you know, because it's powered by wind. But it's, you know, I think it's happening. I think it's happening to some extent. You're right. There can always be more vociferous condemnation. And there can always be policies that are more aggressive with respect to our nation's enemies, so long as we don't do more harm to our country than we are doing to our enemies. And that's part of the assessment, too. But I like the fact that the 9/11 family stood up against these golfers. I like the fact that people are challenging the NBA's relationship with China. It's never going to be. Everybody moves in one direction quickly, and some people will blithely ignore it or be willfully blind to what's going on. You will have people that will condemn, you know, gun laws in America, but not concentration camps in China. I get it. But at least we can highlight the people who are taking important moral and American and moral stands on behalf of American interests. So that's what we're doing here. Dan and Amy, Chicago's Morning Answer.
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. I'm not saying that the quadruple threat, KJP, Karine, Jean-Pierre, has an easy job, but boy, you know.
It's hard to watch. It's like watching a train wreck.
It would at least be nice to see somebody who had enough of a base of knowledge to cobble together a credible response to what
Anything?
Is occurring. And instead, here's what KJP offered over the last 2 days in the press briefings on the American Rescue Plan, jobs, inflation, the economy.
But we are coming out of the strongest job market in American history, and that matters. And that a lot of that is thanks to the American Rescue Plan, which only Democrats voted for that. Republicans did not. And it led to this economic boom, this historic economic boom that we're seeing
and
with jobs.
Also leads to historic inflation.
No, that is not. That is not how we're seeing the American Rescue Plan.
No, of course not.
Of course. That's how we see it, but that's not the truth, honey. That's
yeah,
not what's happening.
And of course, government creates jobs. You start from that premise. Governments create jobs, but monetary policy, in addition to reckless fiscal policy, does not generate inflation. Got it. The economy, everything's doing well.
What we're trying to say, what I'm trying to say to you, is that the economy is in a better place than it has been historically. And so we feel here at this administration, and other experts as well, is that we feel that we are in a good position to take on inflation. We are in a good position.
Well, take your time. I mean, take your time taking on inflation now that you've finally conceded it's not transitory. You're in a good position. You feel that way. Ah, boy, I love when people feel their way through economic policy, through math problems and so forth. Meanwhile, the big guy jetted off to the AFL-CIO convention in Philadelphia.
Oh, yeah.
Philadelphia.
Right at home. Friendly crowd. Ready to go. Ready to go.
Yeah, and he was all charged up because he had a bunch of trained SEALs in the audience, much like Karine Jean-Pierre enjoys, with the exception of Peter Ducey. Or Steve Ducey. No, Peter Ducey. Peter Ducey, Steve Ducey. Peter Ducey, reporter. Steve Ducey, Fox and Friends guy.
Right?
Right.
Right.
Yeah. Okay. The Ducey's. Anyway, at the AFL-CIO convention, Biden demanding that you recognize he's changing people's lives.
I don't want to hear any more of these lies about reckless spending. We're changing people's lives.
What he said.
Republicans in Congress are doing everything they can to stop my plans to bring down costs on ordinary families. That's why my plan is not finished. And why the results aren't finished either. Jobs are back, but prices are still too high. COVID is down, but gas prices are up. Our work isn't done. But here's the deal. America still has a choice to make. A choice between a government by the few, for the few, or a government for all of us. Democracy for all of us. An economy where all of us have a fair shot and a chance to earn our place in the economy.
And then he went on to offer.
Some things never change.
Hey, everybody, an old man's talking.
Grandpa's the name. Did you know this tree dates back to frontier times? Shut up!
A lot of those AFL-CIO members are rather young. For more on what the big guy had to say, as well as his various flacks, including, by the way, I mean, to give KJP a break, she didn't do much worse than an actual alleged economic advisor, Jared Bernstein, the other day on Squawk Box, who said that the Biden administration hasn't missed much when it comes to inflation. We're pleased to be joined by Jonathan Honig, the capitalist pig. He's also a Fox News contributor and the author of a new textbook of Americanism, The Politics of Ayn Rand. Jonathan, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Dan, my eyes are rolling back in my head here. My jaw is dropping the floor. You know, you don't have to be an economic genius. You don't have to have gone to, you know, a big fancy economics degree to understand. I mean, Milton Friedman said it. There's no such thing as a free lunch. And this inflation, Dan, I mean, it's, you know, we've often talked economics over the years. This isn't some little stat, you know, that's, oh, well, this is it. We'll keep an eye on this. I mean, this is affecting every American day in, day out. You can't avoid it. It is not transitory, and it's not being helped by the so-called American Rescue Plan, as you said, as if America is rescued by government spending, certainly the American economy. It is being fueled by that. It is the government spending that created the inflation that's fueling it. And look, Gerald Ford called inflation public enemy number one. We have a president now who's barely even acknowledging inflation. I think we're in for some tough times.
Well, and the riff I love too is sort of the pat line to give with your workers of the world unite a boilerplate is an economy for the many, for all Americans, or for the few. Well, right now we have an economy for all Americans that are suffering under double digit inflation, and we have I mean, in that sense, but it's really the few who can weather it because, you know, it disproportionately impacts people that are at the lower ends of the socioeconomic ladder.
Oh, sure. I mean, Biden would never raise taxes on the poor, right? That doesn't come off so great at the AFL-CIO, as you guys know. But that's exactly what he's doing. I mean, think about it. Inflation is running at about 8-9% a year. I think that's actually kind of low, but let's just take their numbers. So if that, you know, less well-to-do or any of our listeners are, if you're not making 9% in a pay raise every year, your standard of living, your quality of life is going down. And, you know, Dan, that's something that's, as we said, and Amy, it's difficult to put on a spreadsheet, but we know it, we feel it, we're feeling it every day. And, you know, even Carter, you got to give him credit. Carter gets a lot of slack, but he saw the writing on the wall. He had some free market voices. He deregulated. He cut some taxes. Reagan got a lot of that headwind. And Biden is going just in exactly the opposite direction. More spending, more government assistance and programs. And the poor, as you said, they're going to feel it even more, not just in terms of more expensive to buy things, Dan. That's what we see. But as you know, as Bastiat always says, what you don't see, what about the jobs that aren't made? What are the innovation that doesn't occur, the investments that can't occur by those evil rich guys because of the inflation? So it's just a double-edged sword, cutting off the head and tail of the U.S. economy, and government's to blame.
Well, in order to fix a problem, you have to admit that you have a problem. And what I heard from Biden yesterday, I mean, he was just saying, look, we've created 8.7 million new jobs, and he blamed Putin again for this. So inflation, in your mind, is it a combination? Because it was running a little hot before Russia invaded Ukraine, but it was fueled by supply chain issues, and don't you think massive pandemic stimulus spending?
Well, that's it. I mean, inflation, there's a definition for it, and it's not simply rising prices. It is a unusual and extraordinary expansion of the money supply. And that's why, Amy, as you're alluding to, look, we've seen price spikes before, but it's not just like, oh, just drugs or just prices, oil prices are spiking. All prices are spiking because all of our earning power and purchasing power is going down commensurately. So certainly there's kind of hot spots here or there, and that's why it's spending that has to be addressed. And no one had a problem with it back over 2 years ago. Well, $2,000 checks for everyone. Well, why not $3,000?
Right.
You know, we were so quick to want to spend all that money, the Paycheck Protection Program. We're paying for it now. Slower growth, higher inflation, lower quality of life. And as we said, in Biden and the Dems and Feinstein just want to do more.
Well, the rest of his plan that he was referring to includes tax increases that would contract supply, which is exactly what you don't want to do in an inflationary environment.
Yeah, I mean, tax increases. So basically less money going. And the irony is, you know, Dan, less. Honestly, who do you trust with ultimately to make financial decisions? People like Elon Musk, Jeff Bezos, or people like AOC and Joe Biden? I mean, at least when wealthy people and anyone who makes money can keep it, they make the decisions. And as we said, they're the ones that create the jobs, that create the wealth. I mean, you know, I know there's all this focus on the FOMC today, but what is the economy? It's not a piece of paper at the FOMC. It's all of us having mutually beneficial, profitable relationships with each other, you know, as workers, as buyers, as suppliers. All government does is get in the middle of that. And that's what it makes this inflation so difficult. I mean, Dan, we've seen short-term interest rates on the five-year note go up from about less than 1% to over 3% in just the last year. So, you know, no matter what size your business is, how can you make decisions 6 months, a year, 3 years down the line when you have no idea what your costs are going to be, if your supplies are going to be available? That's what inflation is doing. It's hollowing out the economy from the inside.
Since you mentioned Musk and Carter, this is just an example of where we're at in this country. It's such a good one. SpaceX, Musk's company, and deregulation, which is an important part of this conversation that is under-discussed. Before SpaceX can launch its Starship in support of NASA, the Department of Defense and the greater goal of bringing humanity to the stars, the FAA requires SpaceX must, among other things, listen to this, prepare a historical context report of the historic events and activities of the Mexican War and the Civil War that took place in the geographic area associated with and including the area of potential effects for the Starship. Provide $5,000 annually to enhance the existing TPWD Tackle Loaner program. This funding may be used to purchase fishing equipment for use at existing heavily visited sites and or allow the program to expand to new locations. Participate in wildlife photography introduction and instruction opportunities on site. Make an annual contribution of $5,000 to the Friends of Laguna Anacosa National Wildlife Refuge. Adopt an Ocelot program within 3 months of the issuance of the BO and by March 1 of each year thereafter for the duration of the BO. Funds donated to the program are intended to pay for special events to raise awareness about the Ocelot. That is so Elon Musk can launch a – it is not an onion. This is true. This is FAA requiring this of SpaceX before they launch its Starship in support of NASA.
And in the gilding of the lily there, Dan, as you remember, is Joe Biden, when confronted that Elon Musk was expressing some concerns about the economy, Joe Biden said, oh, well, why doesn't he just go up in his spacecraft?
Because he can't, because the FAA won't let him, because he hasn't donated enough to save the Ocelot. What the hell?
I mean, you think the Wright brothers would be allowed to get off the ground, 120 years ago today? We would still be riding Schwinn's and bicycles around.
Honestly.
It's a perfect example. And if then people say, oh, you're always talking about government deregulation. What good could it ever do? I mean, looking at something as simple as a plane ticket, which since that, as you know, government deregulation in the mid-1970s, under Carter, has only gone down in price. Same with stock commissions, trucking rates, and every other element. So, Biden still has some time. He wants to turn the ship around, but it's the philosophy that's got to change. Smaller government, smaller intrusion, and less putting down not just the big guys, but anyone who works for a living and wants to do the outrageous idea of keeping the dollar he or she earns.
Yeah, and of these, they're so they're such penny pinchers. They're so fiscally responsible there. According to a report from the GAO, the rate of improper payments made through unemployment insurance claims increased from 9.2%, amounting to $8 billion in fiscal year 2020 before COVID, to 19%, amounting to $78 billion in fiscal year 2021. I mean, so, fraud, $78 billion in fraudulent unemployment insurance payments, that's just a rounding error. That's just a number on some report. We send $40 billion in aid to Ukraine for weapon systems, and we're having a Senate debate, and we're talking about it on talk radio and so forth. $78 billion just gets frauded out of the government, and nobody says anything. And point of fact, as you know, as we've talked about, hundreds of billions of dollars in all that COVID funny money that was seized by foreign adversaries and criminal gangs in this country, and nobody says anything about it. And then then it comes election time. Everybody wants to talk about belt tightening and how we're going to be fiscally responsible and wise with the taxpayer dollar and so on and so forth. What a farce!
Yeah, a complete farce. And Dan, in fact, they look for it. There's still the old broken window fallacy. There's that idea. Well, the more government spends, the more stimulus you had. But as you said, look, whether it's $5 billion, $100 billion, all that money, all that effort, it doesn't come out of thin air. It is paid for by the hardworking men and women who get up every day and go to work. Government can only distribute the wealth that's created by us, the people. So that's what's so insidious. I mean, as I said, Milton Friedman said it, there is no free lunch. And, as Biden and many on the left try to blame tech innovators, business innovators, productive individuals, the evil so-called rich, I mean, they're the ones that have produced the wealth. They're the ones that create the jobs. That's what we want to be rewarding and encouraging in this country, not the entitlement mentality and big spending government, which the left just simply cannot seem to get their heads out of.
All right. So you mentioned the 0.75% interest rate hike coming from the Fed today. What is your assessment of impact? Does that mean this month we hit peak inflation and the Fed starts to bring it back towards its 2% goal at some point in the not too distant future? Or does the uncertainty remain?
Looking to history, Dan, this is not a genie or, I guess, a demon you can simply stuff back in that bottle. The inflation that we often think of being associated with the late 1970s. I mean, look, Ford was dealing with this, 8 or 9 years earlier. So that's really my fear, that this is not, something that can simply be stuffed back in the bottle, that this is really towards a longer term trend. And, although the stock market didn't go down every day in the 1970s, it was just a long period of economic, again, using Carter's words, malaise. So that's my real fear. Not the country's going to implode, riots in the streets, but all that privileged spending and the continuation of it in Washington, D.C. is going to put a real – it's going to be a real difficult time to not only make money, save money. I mean, even keeping your money in a savings account in the 1970s was very difficult. As any of our listeners might remember, the purchasing power of those assets became lower and lower. So, you know, there was some articles circling in recent weeks about a $20 or $30 plate of chicken wings. It sounds like the onion, but inflation keeps going. That's the direction we're headed for consumers in this economy.
He is the Capitalist Pig, Jonathan Honig, founding member of the Capitalist Pig Hedge Fund and Fox News contributor, author of a new textbook for, excuse me, a new textbook of Americanism, The Politics of Ayn Rand. Jonathan, thanks as always.
Best to be with you. Be well.
Thank you. And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
You've made the switch. And it feels so good. You switch to Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. America First with Sebastian Gorka. Today at 3, right before Sean Thompson at 4 on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. So yesterday, the Senate's grand bargain on guns got the backing of one Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell. Means that's 11 Republicans, that's 61 votes, that's filibuster proof. But what would the impact of this grand bargain be on public safety were it to pass in its current form? To help us with that, we're pleased to be joined by John Lott, president of the Crime Prevention Research Center, former senior advisor for research and stats at the U.S. Department of Justice's Office of Legal Policy, and author of books including Gun Control Myths and More Crime, excuse me, More Guns, Less Crime. John, thanks for joining us again. Appreciate it.
It's great to talk to you. Thanks for having me on.
So a few billion in funding for mental health, whatever form that takes, closing the so-called boyfriend loophole, allowing access to juvenile records for those 18 to 21 before they purchase a gun. What say you to some of the provisions included in this grand bargain?
Well, it's kind of hard to judge it yet because we don't actually have the text of what they're trying to do. Some of the things like the boyfriend, so-called boyfriend loophole, you know, I don't even know what they're referring to in the sense that domestic violence type incidents, whether it be between a married couple or between a boyfriend and a girlfriend, are already ban you for life from being able to go and own a gun.
Yeah, that is a curious one.
I was worried about your concern.
What I mean, does that mean like if you got an order of protection but there was no criminal sanction against the individual, that individual could be prohibited from owning? That is not clear to me. I don't know what the loophole is. I mean, the crime is the crime whether you're married or not.
Right. So, you know, who knows? A lot of these things are kind of made up terms just so they can, you know, push something. So you have things like the Charleston loophole that we could talk about or other things. And, you know, it's if they often use it to make a completely new law that's kind of unrelated to what the original concern was. So, but, you know, things like the raising the age that you can access juvenile records till 21. You know, again, it's going to be a lot in the details. Do I think that you can learn something about an individual that's, you know, 16 and goes and commits a crime and that somehow you don't know that information about them when they're 18? Yeah, I think you probably can learn something. But, you know, in the past, we've always assumed that if somebody's young and they commit a crime of some type, you don't want them to be stigmatized for the rest of their life. You want them to be able to have a chance to start fresh on that. I want to see how they're going to make sure that the records are actually going to be removed at that time. Because, you know, as you mentioned, I worked in the Department of Justice. It's not obvious to me once you put those records into their adult files how they're going to be removed. On that score, too,
I don't want to leave that one because I think that is interesting, too, given the politics of this. So at the one hand, you have an entire party that is for expungement of juvenile records, expungement to some extent of adult records when it comes to crime. On the other hand, the same party wants to say we're going to access those records to prevent you from owning a gun. It's sort of indicative of not so much doublespeak or hypocrisy, but their desire to remove the individual right to own a gun from as many people as they can as quickly as they can.
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, I think if they had their druthers about this, what would happen is that your juvenile record would prevent you from being able to go and own a gun for the rest of your life, just as they have for other things. I mean, if you have mental health issues when you're 17, for example, or 18, you are banned for life from being able to go and own a gun, you know, even though it may be a temporary problem that was there, and by the time you get to be 40, you'd be completely cleared of any types of problems that you might have.
Well, John, who's going to decide whether or not someone's 18 to 21 is mentally fit? Are they going to have panels to decide, or is the local police officer? Because it sounded like that they're going to get local police involved if somebody walks in between 18 and 21 and wants to buy an assault rifle.
Yeah, again, it's hard for me to comment on something until I actually see what the proposal is that they're going to put together. And I'm not sure that they're going to be able to hold together all 11 of these Republicans on all these different provisions that they have. Of course, what I do see in this agreement is that if they can't come to an agreement on certain parts, they're still going to work on creating an agreement on other parts that are there. Look, to me, the most obvious thing here, we look at these recent mass public shootings, and they're not dealing with what I think would matter most. The Oklahoma hospital attack was in a place where guns were banned. The school shooting in Texas, even though 30% of the schools in Texas have armed teachers and staff, this was one of the schools that didn't allow it, that banned it. You look at the Buffalo shooter case. If anybody actually reads his manifesto there, he spends a lot of time talking about how he picked the target that he did. And one of the key factors that he mentioned multiple times was going to a place where he knew people wouldn't have permanently concealed handguns because he knew that it would make it much more difficult for him to go and successfully do his attack. You know, you go through, and he's not alone. I mean, there are other manifestos. There's other diaries. We've collected a whole range of them at crimeresearch.org. You know, these attackers may be crazy in some sense, but they're not stupid. Their goal is to try to get media attention, and the way they get media attention, they know the more people they kill or harm, the more media attention that they're going to get. You know, I'm not talking about what's gutting the First Amendment, but you have to, if you're going to try to take away their desire to do these things, you're going to have to take away their desire to get media coverage or their ability to get media coverage. And the way you do that is by having somebody there on the scene that they can't identify beforehand to stop the attack. So look, they're talking, one thing that they are talking about is providing resources to have a police officer in each school. Okay, well, guys, if you're going to do that, insist that the officer not be in uniform and insist that somehow he be integrated into the school so he won't be obvious as the person who's guarding the place. You know, the Buffalo shooter, he had cased the grocery store before he went in there. He knew that there was one armed uniformed guard that was there. He knew where the uniformed guard was stationed. And guess who he went after first? He went after that one guard because he knew that once he took that person out, he would have free rein to go after other people there because he knew that that person in uniform was the only person that had a gun there. This happens time after time. People, if you have, whether it's a police officer or a guard in uniform, they have an almost impossible job. The attacker has real tactical advantages there. They go after that person first before the one person in uniform that you have even knows that there's going to be an attack that's going to be occurring. When you have people with permanently concealed handguns, it takes away that tactical advantage that the murderer has.
And
in fact, it would... Go ahead.
Well, and not that this was exactly what you're talking about, but in terms of response here, you have, I mean, compare what happened in Uvalde to what happened in the Dallas area earlier this week, where police responded and killed a gunman who had entered a summer camp with 250 kids and had fired off a round.
Right. Yeah. Look, I can give you also cases. We have dozens of cases in the last few years that we've collected at crimeresearch.org where people with permanently concealed handguns have stopped what police say otherwise would have been mass public shootings. You just had a case about 10 days ago that got almost no news attention. There was a graduation party in West Virginia. A man came up with an AR-15. Mm-hmm. Fortunately, there was a woman there who had a permanent concealed handgun and was able to shoot the attacker there. But police believe that many people would have been killed if she hadn't been present there. But it was kind of a non-news story because right. She stopped it before people were killed. And yet,
so was Dallas. So was the police stopping that shooter in Dallas was sort of a non-news story. Nobody's talking about it now.
Same in Alabama
and Alabama too. Why? Because that doesn't help feed the gun control argument or police in every school argument.
Bias. There's so much bias in this stuff. They want to make it look like this is a surge of white supremacists that are there. And they call the Buffalo shooter a right winger. It's amazing to me that the media gets away with this stuff. Is he a white supremacist? Yeah. But the reason why he was a white supremacist, because he called himself an eco-fascist. The guy believed that minorities had too many kids and that they were destroying the environment by having so many kids. And so,
so that's why he targeted a black supermarket?
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, and part of it, yeah.
But he also was not homeschooled, but he was locked out of his school for a year and a half, and that gave him plenty of time to surf the internet and get into these, white supremacist groups.
But, the thing is, this guy, just give you people talking about mental health things. One, over half the mass public shooters in the last 25 years, we're actually seeing mental health care professionals within like 6 months of their attacks. And yet not one single case did the mental health care professionals were they able to identify those individuals as a danger to themselves or others. This individual, the Buffalo killer, had also seen mental health care experts. A year ago, when he was in high school, he had gone and a teacher had asked him, well, what are you going to be doing over the summer? And he said, well, I'm going to find a school and shoot it up and commit suicide. And so the teacher was understandably concerned. She went to, she flagged him. He was evaluated by two separate mental health care professionals. And they said, well, what about this? And he said, I was just joking. And they said, okay, fine. He was just joking. And they let him go on them. New York has red flag laws. They have assault weapons ban. I mean, here we have Biden going to Buffalo after the attack and say, if we only had a federal assault weapons ban, then attacks like the one that occurred there wouldn't have happened. He bought the gun in New York. He bought a New York compliant gun. And New York's assault weapons ban is stricter than the federal one that Biden was saying would have stopped the attack there. Nobody in the media goes and asks him a question about saying, well, if you say the assault weapons ban would have stopped this, why didn't it stop this attack that occurred?
John, we're going to have to leave it there, but I appreciate that. Excellent point. John Law, president of the Crime Prevention Research Center, former senior advisor for research and stats at the Department of Justice's Office of Legal Policy, author of books including Gun Control Myths and More Guns, Less Crime. John, thanks as always.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
Connect with Dan and Amy using the AM560 mobile app. Download it today at 560theanswer.com/mobile.
Thanks for listening to Chicago's Morning Answer podcast, sponsored by Signature Bank. Signature Bank takes pride in helping customers grow their business and provide unmatched banking expertise, custom financial solutions, and the industry's best technology. So whether you're a business looking for a deposit relationship or needs a ready source of financing, Signature Bank is the right bank for you. Call today at 773-467-5600 to hear how Signature Bank can help your business grow and thrive. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.